A team of archaeologists and scientists say that it has, for the very first time, found pieces of a burial shroud from the time of Jesus in a tomb in Jerusalem. The researchers from Hebrew University and institutions in Canada and here in the U.S. said that the shroud was very different from the controversial Turin shroud. The newly found cloth has a simpler weave than Turin's, and the body of a man wrapped in fragments of the shroud was found in a tomb dating from the time of Jesus near the old city of Jerusalem. And also, a Vatican researcher has rekindled the age-old debate over the Shroud of Turin, saying that faint writing on the linen proves that it was the burial cloth of Jesus. Experts say the historian may be reading too much into the markings, and they stand by carbon dating that points to the shroud being a medieval forgery. However, others say that's not the case. Up next, Barry Schwartz joins us. Turin Shroud, the illustrated evidence, a remarkable story. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Barry Schwartz was the official documenting photographer for the Shroud of Turin Research Project, the team that conducted the first in-depth scientific examination of the shroud. And that was back in 1978, so 31 years ago. Barry is the co-author of Turin Shroud, the illustrated evidence, also the editor and publisher of the internationally recognized Shroud of Turin website, the largest, most extensive shroud resource on the internet. And here he is, complete show tonight on Coast to Coast. Barry, how are you?
I'm well, George, and thanks for having me back on the program.
My pleasure. It's always good to have you back, and fascinating work, by the way. And next hour, your friend Jerome Corsi is going to join us for just a bit.
I understand.
To add his input into the shroud. Lots of stories breaking, Barry, about the shroud. Let's talk about them first before we get into your work.
Okay.
And that was, of course, they talked about a couple months ago that scientists have been able to create a holographic image of the shroud that shows that whatever it was, it levitated in the shroud. What did you think of that?
Well, you know, there was a beautiful holographic image created from the shroud photographs by a gentleman from Panama, Petra Soons. And it's a superb image that captures the spatial or three-dimensional information that's encoded in the shroud's image and amplifies it so that one can actually rotate it the way you would a normal holographic image, and you can see the shape and the perfection of the body. This is a perfect, basically three-dimensional image of a human form. Normal photographs and paintings just don't have that kind of information in them. As far as the levitation, that's a theory that some people have, that the perhaps at some point the body levitated. Again, from a scientific point of view, it's difficult to verify that kind of a claim. And typically when somebody approaches me with that kind of thing, I say, well, look, you know, there's no way to scientifically confirm that.
Confirm it.
Remembering that I was a member of the only scientific team that ever examined the shroud, my focus has always been and continues to be on empirical science, preferably that published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. There's a lot of anecdotal information about the shroud. There are many theories pro and con the authenticity of the shroud. There are many agendas that are out there on both sides of the shroud authenticity issue. And my obligation is to stick really as much as I can to the facts. Remember, George, I'm Jewish, so I did not come into this with any kind of preconceived notions or emotional attachment, and I was a member of a scientific team that had members from Los Alamos National Lab and Sandia Labs and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, so it was a real hard science team, not as some people have portrayed us over the years as a bunch of religious fanatics. So as far as the levitation goes, I really don't have much to comment on that. I really don't know about that.
Okay, now what about this Vatican researcher, Barbara Fraley?
Yes.
Okay. What do you think of this story now?
Well,
she claims,
you know,
that this writing confirms that the shroud, of course, is authentic.
Well, you know, I have to apply the same standards to all these media releases that we hear. And sadly, these inscriptions that Barbara Frail claims are new information actually were first reported in 1997. And by 1999, they had been examined by linguists and scholars who were experts in ancient writings, and determined not to be valid, not to make any sense at all, grammatically, historically, or even language-wise. I mean, in our own language, in the English language, we never have the letters X, Y, Z together in a word, and that's kind of some of the problems that were with these supposed inscriptions. So Barbara's work in that area is relying on old information from 97 that has really been sort of set aside as not valid. So I really, you know, I'm not sure what else she's claiming regarding these inscriptions. I do know that she said something about this being a death certificate and proving that, you know, that the shroud is authentic. But typically in first century, when criminals were crucified, they were typically left on the cross for, you know, days sometimes until their corpses were rotting, actually. And when they needed the cross for the next victim, they would take the bodies off and typically throw them into a pit for the dogs and jackals to eat, not the kind of, you know. They were not placed into common burial grounds, as she claimed, so that the families could then identify them a year later and come and pick up the bodies. That just was never done. There's nothing in the historic record that says that was ever done. So, again, I don't believe that Barbara's claims are, you know, anything new or important, even though they are pro-authenticity. You know, you have to rely on factual information. And, you know, there have been historically many people that have seen other things on the shroud, other kind of images and things, secondary images, I call them. And from my point of view, until there's something that's verifiable scientifically, and not just based on looking at old photographs of the shroud, where a lot of this is coming from, I would say that, you know, one has to discount them. The sad part of it, and I guess I'm going to stick my neck out a little here, is that all of these people making claims have a tendency to be selling a new book at the same time. And, you know, it's kind of tough to find something new about the Shroud of Turin, since they haven't really allowed it to be examined since we were there in 1978. So, you know, you got to come up with some new angle for the book, perhaps.
Absolutely. And they seem to come out during Christmas or Easter.
Well, even more coincidentally, the Shroud is going on public exhibit next year in April.
In its glass case, I assume, right?
In a special case, a special cabinet, bulletproof glass, argon nitrogen atmosphere purge the air out, temperature humidity controlled by computers. So it will be on public display. And it seems that every time it comes out on public display, starting about 6 months ahead of time, we start getting reports from skeptics proving it's a fake or from pro-authenticity people proving it's real. I know that some of the skeptical folks out there that are sort of the professional skeptics, some who you know, George, are planning a special issue of their skeptical magazine, debunking the shroud. And, you know, ironically, it'll probably come out in March or April. And, you know, I used to hear about people saying, oh, well, you know, there's a bias in the media. And I never saw that before. But the more involved I got with the Shroud of Turin, the more I realized there really is a bias. And the bias, well, give you an example. Several months ago, a gentleman named Garlicelli in Italy, funded by the PsyCap, which is sort of a sister organization to America's PsyCop organization, came out with a thing. He had duplicated the shroud, reproduced it, proving it was a fake by using medieval technology and pigments from the medieval times. And, you know, he created something that looked very much like the shroud. Well, how tough is that when you've got my photographs and many other photographs available to use as a basis? Nobody starts from scratch on any of these things. They always use a shroud photograph so it looks like the shroud. And Garlicelli said it was made of red iron oxide. And in the scientific data from 78, published in peer-reviewed journals, is a vast amount of evidence that proved it's not a painting, it proved it's not a photograph. And Garlicelli came out with the same old news again. Well, interestingly enough, he's got a book coming out. So, once again, George,
go figure. Right?
Let me make it. Let me go on the record right now. I do not have a book coming out.
Okay. No, so, you don't.
I'm not selling a book, nor am I pushing any particular theories on the shroud. But I was privileged to be a part of it and study it and see it firsthand and hold it in my hands for 5 days and nights. And
what did it feel like, by the way?
And you know,
I want to get into your work in just a second. But
sure,
what did it feel like to touch the Shroud of Turin?
Well, you know, at the time that I did it, I was 32 years old. I was young and kind of stupid and didn't kind of have a sense. We knew we were doing something historic, but so when I put my hands on it, I'll be honest with you, I expected to arrive in Turin in 78 and take a look with my little 10X magnifier. All photographers carry a loop in their pocket somewhere.
Yeah.
And I expected to take a look and see the paint and the brush strokes and be done and go home and say, well, I went to Italy, you know. It took about 5 minutes after it was laid out before us with my magnifier to realize that in the image area, so there's no particulates, there's no binders, there's no pigment. As a matter of fact, up close, it's very difficult to see the difference between the image and the background. It's only at a distance or when the shroud is photographed and the contrast increased that the image becomes as clear as the familiar image we're used to seeing. So,
do you think, though, Barry, if you touched it today, mm-hmm. would you feel this awe, this incredible feeling?
Well, you know, I'm sort of biased now, George. I mean, I've got 32 years under my belt and studying this object, something I never even wanted to be a part of, and we can talk right. about that. I would certainly consider myself very privileged, as I do for having been given that first opportunity. When you hold the cloth, I think I was a little surprised at its condition. It was in better condition than maybe I expected it to be in. But you also have to remember this cloth has been cherished for many centuries and taken care of pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And so although there were times when it was displayed hanging from a balcony with weights on the end of it to keep it from flapping in the breeze, not since probably the 15th or 16th century had they done that. But you know, to hold the cloth in your hand, I guess from a purely scientific point of view, we now know a lot more about DNA. We all left our DNA all over that cloth. And I would strongly urge us not to put our hands on it without particular proper clothing, gloves, and that kind of thing, just because the DNA that's on the cloth represents anybody who's ever breathed on it, leaned over it, touched it.
That's a good point.
You know, so the contamination factor is so vast that, when you talk about DNA and cloning Jesus from the blood of the shroud, well, in 2002, there was a restoration done on the shroud, and a Swiss textile expert, Madame Fleury Lemberg, spent 31 days handling the cloth, again, without gloves, without a mask or anything, breathing on it. So I'm afraid if we were to do a DNA analysis of the majority of DNA that's immediately found on the shroud, we would find it comes from a Swiss woman instead of a first century man.
Exactly.
I think DNA is one of the things that people like to know about because we hear about it every day on our TV programs. But I think it's one of the things that may never yield any kind of viable conclusive result just because of the contamination factor, notwithstanding the fact that the DNA analysis that has been done on the shroud shows that it is male, it is human, and the DNA is so degraded, which one would expect from at least 700-year-old, if not 2,000-year-old DNA, that no DNA profile could ever be determined, so no DNA analysis could be performed, remembering that DNA analysis is primarily a comparative analysis where you're comparing one sample of DNA to another. Well, we don't have a sample of the DNA of Jesus, so we have nothing to compare it to.
Good point. Barry, we've got a lot of people who know about the Shroud of Turin, obviously. But
sure.
We got some people who are in their 20s, and they don't know what the Shroud of Turin is.
Sure.
Just take a few minutes and tell us what it is.
Well, the Shroud of Turin is a 14.5-foot long, 3.5-foot wide sheet of ancient woven linen. It's a herringbone weave, 3/2 twill, I think it's called. Not typical of a inexpensive cloth, but more typical of an expensive first century cloth. Herringbone twill actually goes back well before the first century, and samples of it have been found going back hundreds of years before first century. So it was not unknown in first century, but it was a higher-end, more expensive piece of cloth. Now, the thing about the shroud, of course, that's unique is that it bears the image, front and back, of a man. Now, people often ask me, how did that happen? How did we get a ventral and dorsal front and back image onto one sheet of cloth? Well, it was a very long piece of cloth. The body was laid into the cloth with the head toward the center and the feet toward at the end. Then the cloth was brought over the head and back down to the feet, remembering that the body's inside, so whatever image formation mechanism created the image acted in relative distance between the cloth and the body and left an image of a man on the shroud.
Remarkable. Okay, and when we come back, I want to talk with you, Barry, about your work and how you got involved with it. What websites would you like us to peruse? I've got a couple for you.
Well, the most important one relevant to the subject matter is www.shroud.com.
Okay.
S-H-R-O-U-D.
When we come back, we'll talk about Barry's work as the official documenting photographer of the Shroud of Turin Research Project, and we'll also get into why people believe it is indeed the image of Jesus. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Barry Schwartz, our special guest. Barry, why do some people, so many people, believe that the shroud has the image of Jesus on it?
Well, George, you know, one of the things that's unique about the shroud is that it clearly depicts a man who has been tortured in a very specific and dramatic fashion. First of all, the man's face has been beaten. You can see the bruises in one cheekbone, both cheekbones swollen, one more than the other. There are scourge marks on the body in the shape of the lead weights that were used on the Roman flagrum. They are sort of dumbbell-shaped weights. There are about 120 of those on the man's body of the shroud, both on the back and on the front, because, you know, when you're whipping somebody, if you get a little closer, it's going to whip around to the front of the body. So there's scourge marks that even on the front of the body. There is also on the body blood stains on the head as if from some cap or crown. The cap would be more accurate of thorns that were placed there. There are many open wounds on the head that have bled.
Now, was that standard torture procedure in that day?
It was not.
It was not.
As a matter of fact, that's one of the issues that sort of hooked me into it a little bit because, you know, the Romans crucified, and there are, by the way, there are crucifixion wounds in the wrists and in the feet, and there is a large spear wound in the side. Now, the crucifixion wounds, common, because they crucified thousands of people. Even the spear in the side might have been done from time to time to see if a victim was still alive, or to make sure, or finish them off, perhaps. Even the scourging might have been common at that point in time. But the crowning with a cap of thorns, to me, in my mind, the only person that we know of in any kind of documented history, and we have four gospel accounts that generally tell the story of what happened to Jesus and are reasonably consistent in that specific area particularly, and that's the thing that sort of leads people to accept that this is the cloth that wrapped the body of Jesus after he was taken from the cross.
What I find so remarkable about this is, for example, if they ever find, really find, Noah's Ark, if they really authenticate the Shroud of Turin, and you may say later, well, we have, it really tells you that the stories in the Bible which talk about these incredible events probably is true. Now, I know on faith we can all assume it's true. But when you start seeing the hard evidence, like they find the Ark or they find the Shroud of Turin and authenticate it, then you begin to say, you know what, the whole thing could be true. And that, to me, Barry, is the incredible story.
Well, I think there's certainly a basis of truth in the Bible. I mean, obviously, it may not be, it's certainly not exactly a history book, although I know there are people who would disagree with that. But from my point of view, when we talk about the Shroud of Turin, you know, George, science will never be able to prove who that man is. So the ability to truly authenticate it the way we would using modern forensic techniques with a serial killer or something like that, we're never going to be able to do that. We can never prove who the man on the shroud is. And I typically say in my lectures that even if we had Jesus' mugshot and DNA and fingerprints, there would still be skeptics. So I don't know that we can ever truly and absolutely authenticate it. From my point of view, one has to look at the empirical evidence, not the opinions that are written into books or TV documentaries or even websites, but the real empirical science that's published in peer-reviewed journals. When you look at that data, there's no doubt in my mind that what we're looking at here is an image that was formed by some mechanism that was most likely a natural mechanism, perhaps supernatural, remembering that science can't really deal with issues that are beyond the realm of science. And so I feel that, you know, the weight of the evidence is there for me to believe that this is the cloth that most likely wrapped the man Jesus.
And what would create then that image? Let's assume, let's go on the basis of assumption for a moment, that that the body of Jesus, after he was crucified in the way you just described, was wrapped with this shroud. What would create the image on it? Would merely bloodstains emitting from his body do that? I think not.
No, actually, it's interesting you bring that up, George, because where there's blood on the shroud, there is no image underneath it, implying that the blood got on there first via contact. In other words, the cloth touched the body in the blood-stained areas, and the blood transferred via capillary action into the cloth. So where there's image, however, there are places where the cloth did come in contact with the body, tip of the nose, top of the hands, top of the legs. And in those areas, the image is darkest. As the distance between the cloth and the body increased as it laid over the body, the image grows more faint, and we've determined, the experts have determined, the physicists have determined, that whatever the mechanism was operated at a distance of up to about 4 centimeters from the body. Anything further than 4 centimeters, the image just faded out. There are no distinct edges on the shroud, as one would expect from an artwork or photograph. The image just sort of gradually fades out to extinction. So we don't really have any specific image formation mechanism that can account for all those properties, particularly because in this cloth-to-body distance business, where the image density or darkness of the image depended on how close the cloth was to the body, it also encoded what we call spatial information, or commonly known as three-dimensional information. Normal photographs don't do that. Normal artworks don't do that. And so yet you have these image properties that, how could that have happened? Well, there are a couple of theories that are, I think, reasonably viable.
All right, pop through them.
Probably the one that I favor the most, because it does account for some of the most difficult properties of the image, is what was originally characterized by a French researcher, I think in the 1930s, a gentleman named Vignon, and he called it the vaporograph theory. And he implied that the vapors coming out of a dead body, which come through the skin, through the nose and the mouth, had somehow impacted the surface of the cloth and left an image there. One of the things we've shown about the image and characterized about the image is that it does not penetrate into the cloth the way something painted would. It's only on the top surface of the fibers. And so in recent years, a number of years ago, a researcher who was on our team named Ray Rogers from Los Alamos National Laboratories came up with a theory. He had rejected this vaporograph nonsense, he said. He called it nonsense 25, 30 years ago. But he revisited that. He was one of the few scientists in the realm of the shroud that has ever stood up and said, gee, I was wrong about something, and I think the new evidence shows that I was wrong. And his theory was that he discovered chemically on the surface of the cloth a polysaccharide, a sugar, if you will, a coating, if you will, on the surface that came from washing the cloth after it was woven in something called saponaria or soapweed, a commonly used a means of kind of like a fabric softener, if you will, that softened the stiff linen and made it more pliable. And it was generally rinsed in that and then rinsed off and then air dried and by evaporation deposited a thin layer of this saponaria on the surface of the fibers. Now, if you lay that over a dead body, what kind of chemical reaction will you get with this polysaccharide? According to Rogers, who was, by the way, a world-renowned chemist, it's something called a Maillard reaction. A Maillard reaction is the same thing, the same chemical reaction that makes beer gold, bread brown. And so he believed that this, the amines or the gases outgassing of the dead body actually impacted the cloth and caused a chemical reaction on the surface of these fibers that is the image. It's very, very subtle, and it's only slightly more yellow or darker than the surrounding areas. Now, a lot of people don't agree with this theory. And I have to say this, that our team went to Turin in 1978 with one goal, and that was to determine how the image was formed. In essence, when we came back and we spent 2.5 years reducing the data and then publishing it in scientific journals, we couldn't answer that question. We could not give one mechanism that would account for the physical and chemical properties that we found on the shroud. You get the chemistry right, the physics doesn't seem right. You get the physics right, the chemistry seems wrong. So a lot of people disagree with this theory, but as I said, it accounts for some of the most difficult properties of the shroud's image. Now, there are many other theories that have been promoted for the image formation mechanism. Some people have said radiation. Others have said a burst of light.
A burst of something.
Energy. A burst of energy of some sort. Yeah. Well, you know, some people would like to believe that it was the energy of the resurrection that created this image. Now, since resurrection is not really a scientific term, I mean, scientists cannot go into a laboratory to resurrect bodies and see what kind of images they can make. So we can't really test that scientifically. So my opinion is this, that those of us that have to stay within the realm of science have to look at the resurrection event as something external to science, at least at this point in time. And staying within the realm of science, we could tell you what it's not. We've proven it's not a painting. We've proven it's not a photograph. But we cannot tell you a mechanism that will account for an image with these particular properties.
Now, wasn't the tomb where the body was placed, there was a big rock in front of it.
That's
wasn't
correct.
Wasn't that apparently moved? It was open and the body was gone, which leads me to believe it did not. The body did not dematerialize and appear somewhere else. It must have come through that opening.
Well, you know, I'm not certain of that, George. I do know that one of the theories of the image formation is that the body did dematerialize and the cloth fell through the body. Through the space where the body had
right.
that the body had occupied, and that somehow left an image on the cloth. Again, you know, in science, George, you can't use an unknown to prove another unknown.
Sure. But why a rolled open rock that in front of the cave?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you, George, I didn't study the rolling rock as much as I studied that piece of linen.
I'd look at all this stuff.
Yeah.
Not as in-depth as you, but I looked at it.
And so, you know, look, I'm going to go where I can with this and be honest with you. There are some things, some questions that, you know, that if I have to step out of the role of somebody who's studied it from a scientific point of view, then we're into a level of, you know, speculation, opinion, perhaps even personal faith. And, look, I don't discount any of those theories from those people. I just look at the evidence, the peer-reviewed scientific empirical evidence that I was a participant in helping to gather, and I have to stick to that stuff and stay within that realm. And it's not easy because this, unlike most objects, this has strong emotional meaning to so many millions of people, and including some of the people who are pro-authenticity and some of the people who are anti-authenticity.
Sure.
So it stirs the emotions the way most, King Tut was a beautiful exhibit, but it certainly didn't stir the emotions, at least not of most people, the way this piece of cloth in Turin does. So I think you have, you know, you're dealing with something that's, you know, think about this. This is religion and science living together on one piece of cloth. Now, you know, in our society, those two philosophies are they're diametrically opposed to each other.
Water and oil.
Yeah, and yet on this piece of cloth, we have a symbol of people's faith, and we have an enigmatic image that science, although this has become the most studied artifact in history, we still can't give you kind of a straight answer as how this might have been made.
Now, I'm not being sacrilegious here, but here's another theory. What if this man named Jesus happened to have come from another planetary system, was on this planet, did these remarkable things that have been documented, was killed, crucified, and they beamed him aboard. They beamed his body aboard. They put him back to life somehow, and they sent him back down again. And the image of the shroud was caused by this Star Trek-like beaming of his body.
Well, I'd say, George, we have an idea for a great new novel then, because, you know, look, I can't speak to that. I mean, you know, it's sort of the last.
It's a theory.
That aliens might have done this or Jesus might have been an alien. I've actually heard that before. Again, it's something that I can't really speak to that in any kind of legitimate way. I haven't studied that.
Don't send me to hell for that one.
No,
right?
No. Listen, well, remember, George, I'm Jewish. So, you know, already I'm sort of the odd man out here. It's sort of an ironic situation that I have found myself in after all these years of, you know, being on your program and documentaries and doing interviews and lectures on the Shroud of Turin, something I never dreamed I would.
Well, are you at conflict with yourself, with your own beliefs?
Not at all. Not at all. And then let me quickly go back to the beginning and tell you how I got involved, and it'll sort of give you a sense of what I was thinking at the time, and then I can tell you what I'm thinking now.
Well, because Jewish people believe Jesus was real, but they don't believe he was the Messiah, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the point. But I had a photographic studio in Santa Barbara, California, back in the 70s, and I specialized in scientific and technical and medical things, but I did all kinds of work, commercial studio.
Mm-hmm.
I was hired as a consultant on a photographic project for Los Alamos National Laboratories. And, of course, with Los Alamos, you know, that had to be something to do with atomic bombs. That's their primary product there, or at least has been over the decades. After 7 months of working on this project with the folks at Los Alamos, I was finished and I moved on. A few months later, the gentleman I worked with on that project called me up and he said, Barry, what do you know about the Shroud of Turin? And my answer was telling. I said, but Don, I'm Jewish. That was my first response. And then he reminded me that he too was Jewish. And and he said, look, some guys have found this, some new properties of the image on the Shroud. They're trying to put a team together and maybe get permission to examine it and try and determine how this image was formed. Well, I was interested in the image properties because I'm a photographer, but I was very hesitant and felt very uncomfortable being involved with something that was so obviously a Christian relic, and I wasn't a Christian.
Well, don't forget, Jesus was Jewish.
Well, you know, so a few months into the project, I turned to Don Lynn, may he rest in peace. He was the imaging project manager at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory for the Voyager, Viking, Mariner, and Galileo probes, just to name a few. He was the true imaging expert of our team. And I remember saying to Don one day, gee, Don, what's a nice Jewish boy like me doing involved with this? And he said exactly what you said, George. He said, Barry, you've forgotten that the man in question is a Jew. And I said, no, I know that. And he says, so you don't think God wants one of his chosen people on our team? And I laughed. And then he gave me some good advice. He said, look, go to Turin, do the best job you can, stop worrying about why. Just do the best job you can. And then he said these words. He said, God doesn't tell us in advance what the plan is, but one day you'll know. Well, that was good enough to satisfy me and keep me on that team. And it only took me 17 years after the event of examining it, holding it, touching it. It took 17 years for the evidence to finally, the last piece of evidence to come in and finally convince me that this has to be authentic. I'm going to quote Arthur Conan Doyle, who once said that if you eliminate all the other possibilities, whatever remains, no matter how improbable, is the likely answer.
Yep.
And in the case of the Shroud, by eliminating all the possibilities, the only thing I was left with was that this is an artifact of the historic Jesus.
Well, have we eliminated all the possibilities?
Well, you know, all the known possibilities to date, I think, you know, there have been, as you know, hundreds of efforts over the decades, especially since we came back from Turin in 78, at duplicating the image on the Shroud and at saying, oh, look, it's a photograph, it's a painting, it's a rubbing, it's a scorching with a hot statue. Well, you know, George, it can't be all those things. And it doesn't have the properties of any of those things. So it's neither a painting, nor a photograph, nor a rubbing, nor a scorch with a hot statue. I mean, we did tests. Look, it was not unusual for us to understand at the time that this cloth might have been a painting. So we took all the tests possible to look for paint and pigments.
Hey, Barry, when we come back, Jerry Corsi's going to join us for a half hour or so as we continue talking about your work, Turin Shroud, the illustrated evidence. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And for the first half hour or so, Jerry Corsi will join us. Jerry's working on a novel on the Shroud of Turin, so we'll talk with him about that along with Barry Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you've been listening to Coast over the past few years, you know Dr. Jerome Corsi. He is a doctor PhD type from Harvard University in political science. He also writes for WorldNet Daily, quite accomplished author as well. And Jerry is joining us and Barry Schwartz as we talk about the Shroud. Jerome has an upcoming book, a novel on the Shroud of Turin. Jerry, what led finally into the novel world? You've always been writing nonfiction.
Well, George, I've always wanted to write fiction. I think in the rest of my career, I plan to write quite a bit more fiction. And the Shroud has fascinated me for decades, and I thought it was a great place to start. And Simon & Schuster loved the book, and so it'll be out in April. It's called The Shroud Codex.
Super. Well, I'm sure we'll talk to you about that when that comes out, Jerome. I wanted to bring you out, Jerry, to talk with Barry for just a little bit. You had a different perspective here. You know Barry. He's on the other line, so go ahead and chat for a little bit. I want to learn from both of you. Go ahead,
well,
Jerry.
Well, first of all, I want to say I've got a great deal of respect for Barry. Barry, as the chief photographer for the 1978 Shroud of Turin research project, I think did the most impressive and by far the most exhaustive and authoritative photographic record of the Shroud that's ever been done. And Barry, I'm going to be very honored to use your photographs in the Shroud Codex, and it's great to talk with you tonight on Coast to Coast.
My pleasure, Jerry, and I was going to kind of tongue-in-cheek say we've got to stop meeting like this. There are people listening.
Well, we've been going back and forth, and I'll tell you, the images Barry has are breathtaking. And it's one thing to read about the Shroud. It's another thing even to see the photographs that are reproduced in many books. But when you see the high-quality photographs that Barry's got, you realize this is the photograph of a real man that's in the Shroud. It's very impressive, and it adds a whole other dimension to the appreciation of what the Shroud is all about.
Well, I appreciate that, Jerry. You know, I got to say this, George, that typically most of the people I deal with are writing nonfiction works.
Mm-hmm.
On a few occasions, somebody will come along that wants to do a work of fiction, and I'm willing to be, look, I'm happy to work with anyone who is interested in getting accurate information about the Shroud of Turin. And when Jerry approached me, I could tell immediately just by looking at his credentials that I was dealing with somebody who was a real scholar in his own right and a great writer and an author. And so I was happy to work with him to try and provide him with the kind of materials that he needs to illustrate, even though it is a work of fiction, to illustrate his book.
Well, one of the things that really, I mean, I've got the anatomical accuracy of the man in the Shroud of Turin, Barry's photographs capture. I just want to kind of plunge in on one or two points. In my novel, I focus on several of the really terrible aspects of the crucifixion of this man in the Shroud of Turin, whom I do believe is Jesus Christ. I think it's an authentic document. I think it's an authentic relic, the burial Christ of Jesus. A burial cloth of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm writing at length in the novel, Shroud Codex, about the scourge marks. And the scourge marks on the body are horrifying. I mean, there must be, the scourging had to be so brutal that the man in the Shroud must have almost died from the scourging. The scourging was with a flagellum, a Roman whip, short leather thongs with these dumbbell metal weights at the end of each thong.
Oh, they snap when you get hit, right?
Yeah, oh, they're terrible. And Barry's photographs are just captured the detail in such a tremendous ability to visualize in three dimensions just looking at the photographs. And Barry, would you agree on that?
I would, and I would say that, you know, if one looks closely at the scourge marks, you'll see that many of them, if not the majority, broke the skin, tore the flesh. There are blood stains on many of the scourge marks. So, you know, when people tell me, oh, well, this is just a fake, and you know, the forensic experts who've studied the Shroud have looked at that piece of cloth as if it were a crime scene. And when a forensic, when three, no less than three forensic experts who've really delved into this have come back and said, look, this is absolutely anatomically correct. The blood stains are correct. Everything is correct. I just can't buy into the forger thing, and those scourge marks are a part of that evidence.
Well, it's other, you know, I also write at length about the wounds in the wrists, and they're not in the palms of the hand.
Correct.
It's very important to note these are in the wrist, because the palms would not support
an adult man crucified, the palms were ripped through the fingers, and various photographs, I think, show in tremendous detail not only the wrist wounds, but the way the blood flowed on the arms when the arms were crucified. And I write at length about this in the Shroud Codex because I think it's one of the more horrifying details. I mean, the record of how the man in the shroud was crucified tells you a lot about how the Romans really brutalized Jesus Christ. And it's the story of a political crucifixion. I mean, the Romans crucified thousands of people. Some they just tied to the cross
right. And
let stay there for hours. But when you examine Barry's photographs, it just makes it snap alive for you. It's a whole other dimension.
Well, one of the other things that's important about those bloodstains at the wrist, the Romans did these crucifixions so often that they were expert at it. They didn't need to try and figure out where do we drive the nails. They knew exactly where to drive.
They knew what to do and
they
how long it would take a body to die, right?
Exactly. So when I look at the bloodstains on the shroud and you look at any depiction of the crucifixion of Jesus other than modern ones that are actually based on the shroud, but any going back through history, always the nails in the palms of the hands. Well, you know, the arms are pretty strong, and when somebody's torturing you that way, you could tear your hand loose, whether the body weight or not would tear through it. You could actually pull it loose if you were nailed in the palm, right between the phalanges there. By nailing it in that kind of fleshy part near the wrist, but the fleshy part of your palm close to the wrist, and at a slight angle, you're going to see an exit wound, which is what we see, by the way, on the shroud. You're going to see an exit wound at the wrist. So why would an artist, a forger, a hoaxer in medieval times go against everything he'd ever seen and put them in the forensically correct place instead of where every artist has depicted these nails? So that's another important piece of the evidence puzzle.
It also impressed me, various photographs of the feet, because the feet, one foot was crossed over the other. And so the feet, especially in the dorsal view, I believe it's what the right foot that was against the crossbar. Is that correct?
That's what's believed. What we see on the shroud, it's very interesting. We see a blood mark from a heel. That leg was stretched out completely. Then we see a complete footprint of blood and stains on the shroud. And the only way that a human being can lay his foot flat is to bend his knee. Well, one knee was bent. The body was in rigor mortis, perhaps from after being taken off the cross, and his body was already in rigor. And so, again, we have another important piece of evidence here that what's depicted there is not typical of any kind of artworks of any kind of Christian art of Jesus. It's just not at all what we see on the shroud.
Well, and even how a modern artist could have gotten this anatomical detail so precise. I mean, when you look at Barry's photographs, it's not just that you see the full foot on one of the feet that was pressed against the cross and the blood mark, but the other foot, you just see a slight imprint of the blood, which clearly means the foot was pressed on top of the other, and the bent knees in the photographs are a clear indication of how the body was placed on the cross. So the photographs, I think, do two things. One, they document anatomically correct images that would have been almost impossible for any artist, even today, to duplicate in the detail you see in Barry's photographs. But secondly, they document a story of the brutality with which this man was crucified, which identically corresponds to the story that's in the Gospels. I mean, crucifixion of Jesus Christ was a political crucifixion. I think that's an important point to remember.
You know, and we talked earlier, Jerry, that if this is real, if they ever find Noah's Ark, and, you know, that ends up being real, then it's got to tell you that the rest of the stories in the Bible are real, and that would include Genesis, and that's a remarkable story. And then Revelation, you have to think about that, don't you?
Well, I agree. And, you know, George, World Net Daily, we've documented so much. It's one of the themes of World Net Daily, that the Bible is documentable. And the evidence, even if we look at the evidence of the Second Temple, I mean, recently there's been some coins found in Jerusalem with the burn marks. I've been in Jerusalem many times. I've gone through the various sites, including the archaeological sites, where you can see the burn marks from the Romans in 70 AD, I believe it was, destroying the Second Temple. The Bible is historically documentable. And
right.
That's what's so incredible about the various photographs in the Shroud. It's like looking into the Bible in real time. It's like it's actually right there in front of you.
Well, you know, not being a New Testament guy, I had a lot of learning and catching up to do and once I really got involved with the Shroud. One of the things I noticed about the gospel accounts of what happened to Jesus, I believe there's four different accounts, and they're not exactly the same. And that, to me, indicates truth, because humans don't ever do anything exactly the same way each time. And if each of those stories had been exactly the same, I would have probably been less likely to accept them. There is enough variation within the story for me to accept that that was a reasonably good document of what was done to Jesus. And when you compare that to the Shroud, it's so identical. I once had a skeptic say to me, oh, well, the Shroud can't be real. It's too perfect. And I said to him, so if it were less perfect, then you'd accept it as authentic? He said, of course not. So those of us who studied the Shroud from a scientific point of view have sort of got to face that reality all the time, that we're always going to be challenged, we're always going to be criticized, and no matter where the evidence lies, no matter where it's published, there's going to be skeptics. It's just one of the things that we have to contend with when you're dealing with something at this level of controversy.
Well, if, for some reason, it was created, when might that have been done? If let's take the posture for a moment, it's some rendition of an artwork. You don't believe it. I don't believe it. Jerry doesn't believe it. But when do you think it was done? When do you think they had that capability?
Oh, 50 years from now, perhaps.
From now, right?
From now. Because, look, every effort, including the recent Garlicelli effort, which was a pretty good effort, I have to admit, still didn't pass any of the tests. So, you know, and they have my photographs of the Shroud to work from, and the other more recent photos even. So, you know, if we can't duplicate it after we've characterized the chemistry and physics of it, if we can't duplicate it when we have great photographs of it available for anybody practically, you know, to me, you know, the irony of this is, just knowing about the bloodstains being on the cloth first, an artist would have first had to forensically accurately put bloodstains onto a blank sheet of cloth and then somehow create an image around those bloodstains that's forensically accurate. Well, that's ludicrous. Nobody can do that.
I spent a lot of time writing about this when I wrote the novel. And the issues, you know, when you take a look at Barry's photograph, just a little detail that hit me almost immediately was when you look at the shoulders in the dorsal view, there's a sloping to the shoulders, which is a natural characteristic of someone looking at them from the back, which, you know, an artist to do that, to capture those kind of details and the blood flows on the back from scourge wounds would have had to have almost had a crucified body from which they were painting.
There are abrasions. On the shoulders, Jerry, there are some abrasions there.
Correct.
That people have characterized as there's blood stains there as well that indicate that this man may have carried something across his shoulders that actually rubbed his skin raw there.
Yes, right. To have made this a forgery, an artist would have had to have not only known the four different stories of the Bible, but to have had to have been an anatomical genius. And I mean, I've written, George may remember, I did a pop-up book on Leonardo da Vinci going back almost 15 years
ago. That's a long time ago, yeah.
And Leonardo da Vinci, who is often considered to be one of the people who may have forged the Shroud, while Leonardo's work were probably the most brilliant anatomically of the medieval period, I've never seen any Leonardo drawings which capture nearly the detail or the vivid nature of the photographs you see that Barry has.
Well, never mind the fact that Leonardo wasn't even born and the Shroud was already documented 100 years into the historic record. So.
Right. Okay, exactly. Jerry, let's take this posture for a moment. Okay, let's assume it's real, which means we had this incredible human being who possessed these incredible powers of resurrection. He had the ability to do this, or somebody did for him. Who do you think he was? Historically, who was he?
Well, George, this is why I my novel is the Shroud Codex, because I think the novel is trying to probe into the mystery that's the Shroud. If the Shroud is authentic, which I believe it is, it's a record of the crucifixion and of the resurrection. And that is a dimension that we're only beginning to understand right now with modern particle physics of multiple dimensions, that we don't live in a universe that is defined by the four dimensions we think we live in. So even comprehending how the Shroud may have been created, it, once you get past the fact that there's no evidence that this was a forgery, no one's ever demonstrated how it was forged, then you've got to go into paranormal understandings to comprehend how the image may have been created. That's what fascinated me in the decades that I've studied the Shroud. I'm sure it's the same for Barry.
True, although, as I said earlier in the program, I am bound, because of my position as a member of that scientific team, and because I have less of that emotional attachment that some of the other researchers might have, is to sort of stay within the realm. And trust me, it is a huge, difficult situation to try and stay within the realm of science when you're dealing with this object, because there are so many beliefs that people have based on the Gospels and on their religious beliefs. And, you know, everybody has the right to believe what they believe, but from a scientific point of view, we have to stay sort of within the observable universe. And remember, we observed, studied, and photographed and tested this cloth with every non-destructive test that was available circa 1978. And so there is a wealth of data in the scientific literature that does lead us, led me ultimately to accept that this was authentic. Now, my belief that the Shroud is authentic is not a religious statement.
No, and it's a scientific historical statement.
Yeah, from a historic and scientific point of view, I accept its authenticity. As for Jesus being resurrected or being the Messiah, and the only honest answer I can give is that I don't know. I mean, I don't know that. And as a Jew, of course, you know, the Jews don't accept the Jews. Well, some Jews do. The Messianic Jews do. I'm not Messianic Jew, and I have some people out there constantly praying for my salvation, and I appreciate that. I appreciate their consideration.
Would you assume this, though, Barry? If the Shroud's real, which you believe it is, then that means that something dramatic happened with this individual.
I wouldn't argue that point, George. I agree that there was something certainly unique about this event that created this image, because it really defies every effort to sort of characterize it in a manner that is understood by modern science.
And George, to write the novel, what I was able to get into was the particle physics, the string theory, the multidimensional theories that could explain how this was like an event horizon, that the body, as it were, transfigured and created the image on the Shroud. So as a novelist, I was able to explore those far reaches of science to explain how I see the Shroud as having been created, and I had the liberty to kind of explore those areas without having to be as defined as I would have had to be if I was writing one of my typical books of nonfiction.
Okay, Jerry, we're going to be talking with you time and time again, so I wanted to thank you for bringing your perspective into this, okay?
Jerry, it's a great honor to join you gentlemen tonight, and I've got to say, it's great. I have great respect for Barry and his photographs. It's been an honor to be able to use Barry's photographs in my novel, The Shroud Codex.
Super. And we'll be back in a moment as we continue our discussion with Barry Schwartz, Turin Shroud. We're going to get into the 1988 radiocarbon dating, get his views on that. That determined that the Shroud was made in the medieval period between 2060 and 1390. However, it wasn't the end of the matter, was it? We'll be back. Give us a little chronology, Barry, if you would, of the Shroud in terms of what happened to it, who had it, who then had it, where it was, how the Vatican ended up with it. From the moment, apparently, it was taken out of the tomb. What happened?
Well, first of all, George, the first few hundred years of the Shroud are completely obscure. There's no direct mention of a Shroud with an image in the Gospel. Although there are many biblical scholars who have determined what they call clues or spy clues within the Gospels that indicate they saw something. I always point out to people that remembering that we're talking about a first century Jewish burial, this cloth had bloodstains on it. Bloodstained cloths are supposed to go in the grave with the body. So assuming for a moment the tomb is open, they go in, the body is gone, and they see the cloth, they're not supposed to even have it, possess it, even touch it. And yet this belonged to the man they believed to be the prophesied Messiah. So they were going to have to secret it away and not talk about it and keep it a secret. The first depiction of Jesus looking like the man on the shroud doesn't come along till about 285 A.D. in one of the catacombs in Rome. So there's this first gap in the history of the shroud that, of course, gives us the skeptics lots of ammunition against its authenticity. There was a cloth in Constantinople called the mandilion, which in Greek, by the way, means not made by human hands. And that cloth was reported to have a depiction of Jesus on it and was purported to be the burial shroud of Jesus. Sadly, that cloth, when the Crusaders sacked the city of Constantinople, it disappeared, never to be seen again. In about the mid-1300s, a French crusader by the name of Geoffrey de Charnay, the great-great-great-great-grandson of another French crusader named Geoffrey de Charnay, shows up with it in his possession. His great-great-great-great-grandfather had participated in the sacking of Constantinople. So you can't really make a direct connect there, and any courtroom would say, well, there's a break in the chain of custody. But it's somehow ironic that another Geoffrey de Charnay shows up with the Shroud of Turin when his distant relative had been a participant in sacking the city where this other cloth had been purported to have been kept. Supposedly it had been walled up in the wall to protect it from the Crusaders, but it disappeared, never to be seen again. Once we get to 1350, the historic record is reasonably well documented from that point until today. It became a part of a dowry that wound up in the hands of the Savoy family. The Dukes of Savoy were the monarchy of Italy. They brought it to Turin in 1578, and it never left.
It was involved in a fire, too, wasn't it?
It's been involved in several fires. In 1532, when it was still in France, there was a fire in the town of Chambéry where it was kept in the church there, and it was damaged with very distinctive burn marks happening the way it was folded that occurred down either side of the image, pretty much leaving the image intact except at the shoulders where the burns actually did some damage to the image area. Those 2 years later were patched by the Poor Clare nuns, and they also sewed a backing cloth onto the shroud to strengthen it from the weakened condition because of the fire. Those burn marks are not the only burn marks on the shroud. There's another set of burn marks on the shroud that predate that 1532 fire, because we have an artist's rendition of the shroud in 1516, and he included what we call the L-shaped burn holes. There's a set of four of those that are on the shroud. And so some previous occasion, there was some damage done, I believe, since the cloth was folded in quarters, and we can tell that by the way the burns went through. When you fold the shroud into quarters, it would fit nicely onto an altar in a church. If you swing the incense censer over it and some of the incense falls out, you're going to get a kind of a jaggedy kind of random type burn holes that we see on the shroud. Those are somewhat masked by the greater damage done in 1532. And so what we have are some real indications that this cloth has suffered its own trials by fire on more than one occasion. As a matter of fact, more recently, in 1997, after the restoration of the dome within the chapel adjoining the cathedral where the shroud is kept and where a special altar was built to store it, an arsonist set a fire in April of 97, almost destroying the shroud again by fire. So it's now no longer kept in that Guarini chapel, but in a special case within the cathedral itself.
What do you think, you know, if it were sold on eBay, how much would it go for?
that's a good question, George.
I mean, it could go for a
fortune. You know, I don't think you could put a price on a priceless artifact. I mean, what would the Sistine Chapel ceiling be worth if you could auction that on eBay? I put it in the same category. It's not really something that you know, first of all, that wouldn't happen. And secondly, if it did, hypothetically, I don't know that the bids wouldn't go into the millions of dollars or tens of millions.
Tell us about the 1988 radiocarbon dating. And to me, it sounds like with all this smoke and fire and, you know what, they may have gotten the wrong pieces. But tell me about this.
Well, okay. It's kind of interesting. In 78, we did our thing. We came back. We published our work by 1981, 82. All of our work was published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. All of the evidence at that moment in time was pointing towards authenticity. And we're talking hundreds of different tests. And everything was leading towards authenticity. Even our own team had been involved in trying to get the authorities to permit radiocarbon dating. Ultimately, in 1988, radiocarbon was permitted. Dating was permitted. Our team had no involvement in that, even though we wanted to. We were sort of excluded from that. The three laboratories were chosen. A special protocol was developed over a series of meetings in Turin by the experts from the three laboratories, actually from seven laboratories originally. Sort of at the last minute, that protocol was set aside. They went from seven labs down to three labs only. Each lab was supposed to do a chemical analysis of the samples before they were burnt and destroyed in the radiocarbon dating process. None of the three labs did any chemical analysis. Even though it was billed as a blind study, the Turin authorities could find no other herringbone woven samples to use as controls. So when they opened the samples, there was only one herringbone woven sample. Obviously, that was the shroud, so it really wasn't a blind study. They knew exactly which sample the shroud was from. Anyway, they date it, and the results come out some months later, and the results say the shroud is medieval from either between 1260 and 1320, I believe, were the dates.
With a 95% certainty, they say this, right?
Exactly. So here we have basically one test performed three times. They took one small sample from one corner. One of the kind of ironic observations, once they got the shroud opened and unveiled and they were ready to cut a piece, they stood over it for an hour and a half sort of debating where the sample should be taken. Now, when I consider the preparation that our team spent a year and a half before we ever went to Turin planning what we were going to do, this seemed sort of ill-advised to not know where you're going to take a sample from and argue about it as you stand over the cloth. They ultimately took it from a corner. They took a small piece off this corner. They cut it in thirds, divided it. Actually, they divided it in half and then put half aside, took the other half, divided that in thirds, and gave it to the three labs. Several months later, we get the radiocarbon date. At that point in time, it was kind of ironic. There's a very famous photograph of the three scientists representing the three labs sitting in front of a blackboard with 1260 to 1390 exclamation point. Not exactly the way you were used to seeing scientists reveal their scientific data. But it sort of was a dog and pony show. And so they make this revelation that the shroud is medieval. Can't be any older than 1260, period. And those of us who had been studying the shroud all these years knew about an illuminated Hungarian manuscript that was done in 1191. It's called the Prey Manuscript. Still exists in Hungary today. And it's got an illustration, an illuminated page of that manuscript. Shows a herringbone woven cloth with the image of Jesus being wrapped into this cloth. It shows a set of the L-shaped burn holes I alluded to earlier. So obviously this monk who did this illumination had seen the shroud, and the reason he included those L-shaped burn holes was they were the darkest and most prominent and visible thing on the shroud before the 1532 fire that put all the burns into it that we see today. So we have this. Also, that depiction of Jesus laying in that cloth in the illuminated manuscript shows him nude, which was unheard of in any medieval Renaissance or even modern art. There's always a modesty cloth or something wrapped around Jesus. So we know that this manuscript is 70 years earlier than the earlier possible date given by the carbon dating. So right away, those of us who knew about it said, well, there's got to be something wrong here. Well, about 8 or 10 years went by, and virtually everything about the shroud stopped, all the research. Everybody just sort of was dumbfounded by this because, remember, all the previous evidence was pointing towards authenticity.
Right.
Now, the irony of it all, I think, more than anything else, is Here we have one test done, not necessarily even according to their own protocol. And suddenly that one test is powerful enough to throw away all the other evidence and discard that and just say, okay, well, this proves it's a fake. To me, there's something not right about that. And what's not right is you cannot deny the other evidence that shows that it's not a medieval forgery. It's, to me, sort of ironic that it came out to be a medieval date since all the skeptics had always argued that it was medieval. So why did a radiocarbon date come back? Well, for years after the radiocarbon dating, there were researchers proposing reasons why. One was that there was a bioplastic coating on the cloth that skewed the date. Others was the fact that it had been burned in the fire, and that might have skewed the date. None of those really held true, and most of them were just set aside by the scientific community because they just didn't, you know, have any veracity. It wasn't until 2000 that two researchers presented a paper at a conference in Italy in which they talked about these the sampled area that was used for the radiocarbon dating. They there were photographs made of those sampled areas by the laboratories, and these two researchers, Joe Marino and Sue Benford, obtained a set of the photographs. And Sue got the idea, just sort of came to her, that she should take these photographs to textile experts and see what they have to say. She didn't tell them it was the shroud or anything else. They just showed them the three different textiles.
Just brought it. Okay.
Each textile expert, when they examined these closely, looked up and said, well, you know, this is a linen piece of cloth, but it's been rewoven. So when she got that the first time, she thought, well, we'll see what the others have to say.
Right.
Each of the three textile experts all said the same thing. There is evidence of a very careful reweaving in this sample area. Well, Benford Marino presented this paper, and their theory was that that corner had been rewoven or repaired at some point in history, not a documented repair, not anything as dramatic as a fire where the repairs were obviously needed, but just a sort of a preventive maintenance. Right next to that area, a big piece had been cut out, probably by the Savoy family, either to give away or sell as relics. And when you take a woven cloth and you cut a piece out of it, it starts to unravel right away. So there is some belief that this corner was rewoven. Well, I published their paper on shroud.com, and Ray Rogers, the chemist from Los Alamos that was head of the chemistry on the STIRP team, called me up and read me the Riot Act. He said, why are you publishing this stuff on your website? These people aren't scientists. They're the lunatic fringe. Why are you putting this garbage up there? And I said, Ray, they went to three independent textile experts. They followed the scientific method. And you don't have to have a string of initials after your name to do good science. And I felt that it was good enough. Well, he said, I'm going to prove them wrong. He happened to have some samples that were taken from immediately adjacent that radiocarbon sampled area. And he went back and he called me about an hour and a half later, very quiet, muted, no longer yelling at me, and telling me that he thought maybe they were right because he found, by doing some quick chemical analysis, that there was not only cotton interwoven in that area, but dye had been applied after the reweaving that was only on the surface where when you remove one fiber where the that had dye on it, the fiber underneath didn't have dye. You could see it had been applied then after the fact. And he said that chemically, he could identify the dye as a rose madder dye from the madder root plant. And he said, I think maybe they're right. And he was shocked. Well, he knew that he couldn't base his science on just the samples that he'd had. They were somewhat in question. So he requested and received a piece of the actual reserve sample that had been cut for carbon dating, and he found exactly the same thing in that sample. Evidence of reweaving, evidence of retouching, if you will, and why was cotton interwoven when the rest of the shroud didn't have cotton? Well, cotton takes dye a whole lot easier than the waxy outer surface of linen. Much easier to dye cotton, and we all wear Levi's all the time. They, you know how they take the dye very easily. That kind of material was there. Rogers then did an intense analysis on the real sample from the radiocarbon corner, did the analysis, and his data was published in Thermochemica Acta, one of the finest chemistry journals in the world. It went through 7 months of peer review before they agreed to publish that article. So their in my opinion, is the closest thing to a scientific answer for what might have gone wrong. And it's a simple, you don't need to be a scientist kind of a solution. They chose a sample that was not representative. That's a huge piece of cloth. And they took one little sample from one little corner, and based on that alone, they declared the whole thing a fake. So now there's another theory that John Jackson, who was co-founder of our team, has proposed in more recent years. He does not agree with Roger's conclusions. John's theory is that the carbon monoxide in the air reacted with the linen and could have skewed the date. Exactly. He is working with Dr. Ramsey at the Oxford Laboratory, one of the three laboratories that actually performed the carbon dating analysis on the shroud. And so they're testing Dr. Jackson's theory, and we don't have any results from that yet, so we don't know if John's theory is is viable, if it's been proven right or wrong yet. But that's another possibility that has not yet been either set aside or proven or whatever. They're still doing the work on that. So what we have, though, is a lot of evidence. As a matter of fact, there's a 60-page article on shroud.com written by Joe Marino and another scientist who collated and collected all the evidence that indicated a questionable nature of this corner, and it totaled 60 pages. So there is a huge amount of evidence showing something anomalous or different about that corner than the rest of the shroud. And I think that's the most logical explanation so far until we hear the results of Dr. Jackson's theory.
What about DNA testing? Can they test the blood, or
well,
is it just too degraded?
There was a DNA test done in 1995 at the University of Health Sciences in San Antonio, Texas. The sample that had been provided came from Dr. Garza Valdez, a man who had obtained the sample, and he was the man who proposed the theory of the bioplastic coating that was later proven incorrect. He took this sample to a gentleman, to a doctor there, a scientist there, and they did a DNA analysis, and they determined male human DNA, but so degraded that no profile could ever be taken, and they could never get a complete profile because it's so old and degraded. Interestingly enough, because that sample was never authorized for a DNA analysis test, the Turin authorities demanded the sample be returned and said that they could never stand by the results of this set of tests because they'd never authorized them. Interestingly enough, though, we know that it was a legitimate and authentic sample of the shroud, or they wouldn't have demanded its return. So, I mean, in other words, if they said, well, that's not really from the shroud, they wouldn't have demanded that it be returned to them. So I personally believe that the DNA, as I said earlier, is probably not going to be a very reliable test from the shroud, mainly because my DNA is on it, Madame Florey Lemberg's DNA is on it from her handling of it in 2002, and anybody else who's touched it, breathed on it, leaned over it in the last 700 to 2,000 years will have some of their DNA on that cloth.
So we can't clone Jesus, can we?
Well, you know, I've heard this many times, and look, you can't clone someone from an incomplete DNA profile. You know, you've only got a few segments of DNA there that are still viable at all.
There's another novel there for you.
Well, there is.
Well, we'll be back in a moment. We'll continue chatting, and then we'll take phone calls next hour on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, this hour we're going to take your phone calls with Barry Schwartz as we talk about the Turin Shroud. We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. Barry, before we go to calls, if it's authentic, what does it really mean?
Well, you know, George, that's the ultimate question. And, you know, the Shroud didn't come with a book of instructions for us to understand it or to explain what it means. And I don't think that the answer to what it means is really on the cloth as much as it's in the eye and the heart of the beholder. Each of us has to, I think, just look at it, study it, and ultimately decide what it means for ourselves. Because I think it's an individual thing, and each person has to reach that point on his own. So it's not an easy question, but I think the correct answer is that each person has to decide what it means for himself.
I think so, too. Let's go to some of the calls. Sunland, California, first-time caller, Lindsay. You're on with Barry Schwartz. Hi, Lindsay. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good.
I've taken days and days to get a hold of you. Barry, I have a good question for you, and happy Hanukkah to you and your family.
That's the problem, though, Lindsay. It should have been nights and nights to get a hold of me.
Oh, that, honey, it has.
You've
been
calling during the daytime. Okay.
No, nights and nights and nights. Believe me. I'm a nighttime person. My question is, because of the Hebrew laws at the time of the first century, when Christ was taken down off the cross, he was taken to the tomb, and Mother Mary and Mary Magdalene bathed them, which was a ritual to bathe and then anoint in olive oil and spices and perfumes. Now, was that ever discovered on the Turin?
It is a good question. Actually, because we knew of what it said in the Gospels, we were looking for aloes and spices and any of the kinds of oils that might be used for anointing. But I have to remind you that when Jesus was put in the tomb, it was shortly before sunset, the beginning of the Jewish Sabbath.
Of course. And also, it was Passover.
Yeah. And so they were really not permitted to work after the Sabbath. And I don't believe there was time to perform the complete ritual. And the intent was to come back on Sunday after the Sabbath and complete it. We found no traces of any of those types of things on the shroud, and I think that further supports that. Also, I do believe, however, that they did wash his body. I mean, no Jewish mother or any other mother, for that matter, would allow their child to lay there covered with dirt. And so they did, I think, a washing. And I think the forensic expert, Dr. Fred Zugabee, supports that with what he's found, remembering that the blood blocked the image formation mechanism. If he were just soaked and covered in blood head to toe, we wouldn't see an image. So there's strong indication that he was washed, but not completely, the burial practice was not completed.
See, a lot of Christians don't understand that most people that were crucified were hung on the crosses for days.
And Christ, they did.
Christ,
that's correct.
Christ was taken down because it was also the Sabbath, but it also was Passover.
Right.
And that's why he was allowed to be taken off the cross at an early time.
Right.
And
he had already
Christians argue this, and I'm going, hello, argue with me.
remember that when you deal with the Gospels, you're dealing with people's interpretations. And
that's true.
People's interpretations are based on their own education, their own learning, their own studies, and their own personal feelings. And, you know, you have to accept that there are going to be differences in these interpretations. The one thing that I can say about the shroud that's a given is that it absolutely accurately depicts a human form that suffered these tortures.
I've seen your pictures, and they're excellent.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I was just floored by them.
They're pretty amazing. I mean, the image on the shroud, as subtle as it is, once it's photographed and the contrast is sort of brought up, you know, it's a very powerful, striking image of a man who, I remember what Don Lynn said, the thing that amazed him the most about the shroud, you see this body tortured beyond belief, and yet the expression on the face is peaceful. So that's an observation that Don made as we stood before the cloth in 1978.
And how tall was the person again?
About 5'11". Remember that the shroud is a piece of linen that can change its shape as much as a few centimeters just based on the relative humidity of the storage
that it's in.
And it's a stretchable cloth. Remember, they used to hang it with weights on the bottom of it from a balcony in the 15th, 16th century. So a precision answer to the question is impossible, a precise answer, but about 5'11". And a lot of people said, well, he's too tall for first century. But they have found remains of six-footers. So, you know, we have no physical description of Jesus that, you know, is a totally reliable one. And so, you know, 5'11", tall, but not. Somebody wrote me recently and said, oh, the man on the shroud, it's a fake because he's 6'9". Well, if he were 6'9", I would agree it would be a fake. He's about 5'11".
Let's go to Chicago. Bob, it's your turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Bob.
Okay, George, thanks. Yes, sir.
Sure.
Here's my question. Is there any documentation from the Romans who were supposed to be guarding the tomb? We never hear too much about that. They were supposed to be guarding that tomb because they were told that that body of Christ was going to be stolen. or could be stolen. Is there, to your knowledge, the best of your knowledge, is there any Roman documentation at all as to what happened there?
No, I kind of wish there were. The Romans were pretty good at documenting things, but to my knowledge, nothing has been found that is specific to that particular.
Well, and one of the reasons for that, Barry, if I can, and also you, Bob, is I believe the soldiers did not want to say, we fell asleep. They came and stole the body. So assuming they did not fall asleep, they didn't have any explanation other than to say, we don't know. And then, of course, the stories at the time was that he resurrected. I think the Roman government at the time was so embarrassed and didn't want that to get out, they just kind of swept it under the carpet.
You know, okay, George, but do you know if that was documented at all?
I don't think it was. You know, I've seen it in Hollywood movies and things
right.
like that, but I've never seen any documentation or any ancient texts or anything that talk about the fact that how did the body get out? What happened? I do know that they were concerned, as you mentioned, they were concerned that his supporters of the time, they were going to talk about this resurrection because it was known amongst them that this was going to happen. They didn't want that to occur.
Right.
And so they guarded that tomb 24/7.
Well, we know that even to this day, governments will often sort of hide things that might prove to be embarrassing politically or any other way. So I don't think that things that much has changed over the centuries. I think governments still do that from time to time.
Thank you.
All right, Bob. Thank you. This is fascinating. I would love to be back in that time period.
Would be great to go back and have a look for ourselves, wouldn't it, George?
Yeah. Clearwater, Florida. Laura, it is your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi, Laura.
Hi there.
Yeah.
Hi.
First of all, I just want to say that I've really enjoyed listening to your show many, many times.
Thank you. And this one is no exception. Thank you, Barry.
Okay. And, what happened to me, and this is something ethereal that happened, I was praying for help, and there were like a group, and I was like kind of, I guess, in a trance frame of mind, and there was like a group of spirits or angels or something that came to me, and they had this, it was like an ethereal piece of linen or whatever, and they let it come down on me, kind of folded, and then when it was done, it was the Shroud of Turin, which I had never really thought about very much, and it was the picture. It was his head with the crown of thorns, and then they said to me, "Remember, he will always be with you. This will always be with you." Basically, I felt like it was protection. I was protected, and after that, well, then I went to look for a book on the Shroud of Turin. And anyway, that's an experience I had. I don't know if other people have had that type of experience.
You know, I've, over the years, have had many people report to me that they have either had a vision or in a dream have seen the face and didn't even know about the Shroud. And then when they found out about the Shroud, they recognized that face. Obviously, from a scientific point of view, there's not a lot I can say from a scientifically about that. But look, the Shroud has significance to each individual in a different way. And I don't doubt for a moment that when people have these experiences, that they're very real, authentic, and genuine to that person. And remember, if the man upstairs decides that he wants to reach out to you, and he'll do it in a way that works for you, and it might not be the same for me. So I don't dispute these kinds of things, and when I hear them, I think, well, you know, maybe that was a real gift and a blessing for you, and if it had a positive impact in your life, then it was a worthwhile experience, and nothing there to challenge. And others have reported similar kinds of stories.
Barry, tell us a little bit about the tour. Again, the Shroud is going to take, where they're going to be.
Well, it's only going to be in one place. The only place the Shroud is ever publicly viewed is in Turin, in the Cathedral of St. John the Baptist. Next year will be the first public exhibition since the year 2000.
from April 10th through May 23rd. It will be on public display in the Turin Cathedral. There's no charge for admission, but reservations are required. You need to go online to the Archdiocese of Turin website. If you go to shroud.com, to the late-breaking news page, there are links to the place where you can sign up and register for, to make a reservation to see the Shroud. There are tour companies offering tours. So there are a number of ways of doing it, but any time between April 10 and May 23rd of 2010, the Shroud will be available to the public. Typically, they only display it three or four times a century, so we really don't know when the next time or the next opportunity will be. So to anybody who has the opportunity to go to Turin next year and see it, if you're interested, this is the time. It may well be the last time in my lifetime that it will be available for the public to view.
Well, that's a good point. Next up, we go to Abilene, Texas, east of the Rockies. Hi, Joe.
Oh, good evening, guys, and thank you for the courtesy, George. Barry, let's see, I've got two quick ones here. The day of the execution, there are two contradictories in Luke 23:56 and Mark 16:1, which says, after the Sabbath was passed, they bought and prepared the spices. The other says they bought and prepared the spices and rested on the Sabbath, as was their custom. The customary Sabbath, of course, our Saturday. The execution would have taken place on a Wednesday afternoon. They had to hurry to get that body into the grave and get themselves washed so they could keep the first day of unleavened bread, the Passover. There are two Sabbaths that week, the high Sabbath on Thursday, the day of preparation of spices on Friday, and then going back to anoint the body on the Saturday afternoon. Get that 72 hours before sundown on Wednesday afternoon, the execution before sundown on the Sabbath on Saturday. The cornerstone of this whole thing is that crown of thorns. Unfortunately, Mel Gibson left out that cornerstone scene from his movie. Abraham went to Mount Moriah with his son Isaac to sacrifice him by orders of the Most High. When he got to the top of the mountain, of course, he bound up Isaac. Just before the knife was to cut his throat, a voice came from heaven, stopping the sacrifice. The voice then continued and said, Yahweh will provide the sacrifice. And he turned aside, and there was a ram, a male sheep, caught in a bramble bush. And that was the animal which was sacrificed as the substitute. And, of course, our substitute sacrifice coming out of the Torah is the Yahshua, the Jesus that we talk about. That crown of thorns came from that prophecy of the bramble bush, that history of the sacrifice. And that was, to me, an allegory and a signal to the Jews that this was the crown, this was the ram which he would provide in time future, and that crown of thorns being the unique, singular, unique part of that execution, crowning him with the same thorns found in that bramble bush, and the place of the execution planned with Isaac was on the same Mount Moriah in the middle of Jerusalem where the Messiah was executed. I'd like your comments.
Well, good, really good question. Goes in some areas way beyond my own skills and knowledge in that subject. Let me address the crown itself. You know, there are many depictions of a crown of thorns. It's a beautiful plaited, you know, woven kind of thing that fit nicely around Jesus' head. That's not what they did, though. That's not what the evidence on the Shroud shows either. In my understanding, and again, I'm not a biblical scholar, so your knowledge in that area is well beyond mine. But my understanding was this, that this was a way of demeaning him by placing this, because he proclaimed himself the king of the Jews, so they gave him a crown. And it was a demeaning crown. It was just basically smashed onto his head, because the cuts that are on his head are all over the top of his head, not just in a circlet around his head, as has been depicted by artists. So, you know, my knowledge is somewhat limited in the, you know, as far as especially the New Testament gospel, obviously. But I wouldn't debate that part with you. I would just say that from what we can see on this cloth, these wounds on his head were there just because they smashed this down on his head. And a couple of scientists have picked out one of the plants that grows in that part of the world, and it has about an inch and a half long thorns on it that were just strong and very powerful. And you know how easy it is when you cut your head, how much you bleed. His head was covered with these wounds. So
It was not a gentle crown, but a really fierce smashing of this bush onto his head. But I wouldn't, as a matter of fact, I agree with you that it would have been a bush. And if that's a parallel to the thing that you mentioned in the Gospels, I wouldn't debate that with you at all, because they used some kind of a bush or tree of these thorns and smashed it onto his head as a crown.
Okay.
The following comment?
Yeah, please.
The point I was trying to make was that the prophecy was the bramble bush in which this ram had been caught, and that was the substitute sacrifice provided for Abraham
right. And
his entire ancestry onto us. The very same place of that execution is the very same place that the Jesus of the Bible was executed, the very same geographical location to within a few feet. And the pressing down of those thorns, the ram caught in, very much a kind of a scrambled, brambled, a uniquely plated thing. And then this very same kind of plating or non-plating of the crown that you mentioned, that you've seen on the crown, on the Shroud of Turin, I think is an exact parallel, and the prophecy there would have been fulfilled in a very significant way.
I certainly wouldn't argue with you on that. I agree, because if that was what the prophecy said and if that was the meaning behind it, as you pointed out, then I would say what's on the shroud is consistent with that, those passages of the gospel then.
And, you know, the Bible is really, to me, a historical book as well. It's not necessarily just a religious book. Do you agree with that, Barry?
Well, you know, to an extent I do, George, and in some areas I might not totally agree with that. Look, I said earlier to one of the other questioners that part of what we have to contend with when we discuss the Gospels is the fact that there are interpretations. And I've heard, I've lectured in churches, and I've heard one passage be interpreted differently than in a different church by, you know, people who are scholarly in that area. So as I think that the general points of history, particularly the description of the crucifixion and all the things that were done to Jesus, I think that we can look at that with some veracity because there's that consistency amongst the different stories in the Gospels.
When we come back, Barry, let's take some final calls at Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Barry, what's some of the next research into the Shroud? What's going to happen in the future?
Well, you know, George, at this point in time, it's a tough question to answer because as it stands now, remember, we have this upcoming exhibition with the Shroud. The day that the announcement was made by Pope Benedict that he had given permission for them to display it next year, the following day, the Turin Archdiocese released a press release stating that this would be for pastoral purposes only, in other words, only for the faithful, no science would be permitted. So it really rests in the hands of the Turin authorities and the church, which we didn't really mention earlier, has only owned the Shroud since basically 1985.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
That's right. When King Umberto, the last Duke of Savoy, the deposed monarch of Italy living in Portugal, when he passed away, he left the Shroud to the living Pope in his will. It took 2 years to probate the will. He died in 83. In 1985, for the first time in its documented history, the Shroud belongs now to the church.
And I guess they willingly accepted it.
Oh, I don't think they would have even dreamed of rejecting it, remembering that they have been the custodians and the caretakers of the Shroud for about 450, 500 years.
And before we go to final calls, we didn't really talk about the Knights Templars, the protectors of the Shroud.
You know, there was one other thing I wanted to mention myself, George, and at the top of your show, you were reading the news and you brought up the recent, just in the last 2 days, news report that a new Shroud had been found in Jerusalem dated to the first century, made of wool, and that proved the Shroud was a fake. And I really wanted to address that. I know that any of the readers of my website are kind of waiting for me to respond to that.
Absolutely. Sure.
I wanted to say this, that first of all, the Mishnah, the sort of the rules that Jewish customs are bound to, in the Mishnah it states that a burial must be in clean linen raiments. It is permitted under Jewish law for the linen to be interwoven with another fabric, in this case wool. I just wanted to point out to people how ludicrous these claims are, that because they found a different kind of shroud, all it really means is that first century Jews could be buried in different kinds of cloths, as long as linen was part of their makeup.
And I pointed out to someone just today in an email that, you know, when we're buried, we're not all buried in identical caskets. We're not all wearing the same clothing. So just because we find a different type of shroud, it's still consistent with Jewish burial custom. And as I said at the beginning of the show, the linen of the Shroud of Turin would have been a finer cloth than the wool and linen combination that they're describing in the recent news releases. So all I wanted to do was assure people that although they may have found this, by the way, they're claiming this is new, but this was first presented in 2003, six years ago? So this isn't really new. It's being pulled out again and dusted off once again. There's just sort of, because there's a public exhibition coming, we have to say something about the shroud.
Okay.
So I just wanted to address that.
Absolutely. We now go to Fort Worth, Texas. Hello, Kenneth. You're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Yeah, it was the image produced by Septic. It was raining. It's humid that day. Is that possible?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. That's the honest answer. Look, there's a lot of possible explanations for how the image was formed. A lot of people think that it was the oil, the spices, the blood, the perspiration, any or all of which may have contributed to the image. Remember, we're dealing with a very arid part of the world. So I don't know how humid it would have been. If it was raining, certainly the humidity would have been higher than normal.
Sure.
Sure. So that's all I can say is that I guess that's possible.
Yeah, I believe that was the worst day Jesus had in his life, but did the Bible say it was raining and humid that day?
Well,
it makes sense.
Well, the storms came when he died, apparently.
That I do know. I don't know, you know, I don't know the Gospels well enough to be, you know, to give you a definitive answer there.
All right, there you go. Thanks. Let's go next to Kevin in California, first-time caller. Hey, Kev, go ahead.
You know, I've been looking at this shroud for a long time, and I looked at the scientific, they did a movie on it with a scientific individual that when you die, you go see a coroner, and he tells how the person died, and, you know, I take a look at the book of Isaiah, chapter 15.
Well, we're going to lose you, Kevin.
I was going to say, I'm having trouble hearing the question.
We lost him. Try to get back in, Kevin, if you can. That line's still open for you. Mesa, Arizona. West of the Rockies. Hello, Jeff. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
Good evening. Thank you. There was a documentary done some years ago where the face portion of the shroud was scanned with a comparative analysis of light versus dark, and they were able to produce a 3D image of the face, and they were all agog at how could this possibly be? And my question is, has any thought ever been given to perhaps expanding this, making a 3D model either virtually or physically to try and see if this can be reproduced on other cloth?
Well, I don't know if anybody's tried to do it. Well, everybody who's tried to duplicate the shroud has tried to capture the spatial or three-dimensional information that's encoded in it with very poor success in every case. So, however, the three-dimensional aspects of the shroud's image have been converted to a physical statue. This was done by members of the STIRP team back in probably 79 or 80. It's been done in the computer, complete three-dimensional aspects of the shroud were sort of extracted from my photographs. And that was, I believe, in a History Channel documentary. So there have been many efforts made, both using computers and physical models. There are a number of sculptures of the Man of the Shroud based on the shroud and the spatial information. So people have extracted that information and put it into a different form, maybe a little easier for the average person to see. I hope that answers your question.
All right, let's go to Wilmington, Delaware. We're going all over the map today.
Right.
Robert, you're up there on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Robert.
George, how you doing?
Okay, all is well.
Monday through Friday, you are on the man. I have a question about the shroud. Has anyone even decided to make to see if it will perform miracles?
Well, you know, there are, to my knowledge, no formal miracles attached to the shroud as the way the church would do so with, you know, somebody who is
being considered for sainthood or something. But there are many kind of anecdotal reports of people who have been healed, cured, or, you know, have their lives have been changed because of the Shroud. But I don't believe there's been any documented formal miracles that have been verified by the church.
But have they tried to, like, put it on somebody? Like, remember, like,
well,
the robe?
Yeah, unfortunately, they're never going to do that.
Well, I mean, it couldn't hurt to try.
Well, I wouldn't argue with you there, but the way the Shroud is now conserved and preserved, it's not even visible to the public except once every 25 years or so. So for them to go and take it out and allow it to be laid onto somebody's, you know, body, I think it would be, we'd be hard pressed to get the, for anybody to get that permission.
Yeah, but that could be the meaning that why it's here.
Well, I wouldn't argue with you. I'm just saying that, you know, I think that the question needs to be asked to either the Turin authorities or probably the Pope, who is the legal owner of it these days. And I don't know that they would permit that to happen. I just don't really know.
Thank you.
Sure, thank you.
Sure thing. Janice in Detroit, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Janice.
Well, good evening. It's
Hi,
my
Jan.
First time calling.
Motor
great.
City.
Enjoy your show, George.
Thank you.
And it's an honor to talk to Barry.
Thank you.
I've heard you speak before about the Shroud of Turin, and I've seen the burial place in Israel,
mm-hmm.
and have been there. And I think that when you look at the object of the Shroud, which to me it sounds like something that would go over a head, but you describe it as a full-length body wrap. And instead of looking back to the crucifixion, which it obviously points to the man,
and
then you jump over to the resurrection, if you concentrate on the cloth itself, there's a lot of writings, historical writings, in the, especially the book of John, which was Jesus' best friend who wrote the book of John.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who got Jesus' mother. You know, he's the only disciple that witnessed the crucifixion. And so he writes about this linen clothing, and there was two other Jewish guys that were secret disciples that were in the Sanhedrin,
mm-hmm.
and one was Joseph of Arimathea. He was a wealthy man. It was his grave that
it was his cloth, and
yeah,
I think
and
I pointed
the
out
one was Nicodemus, and they both were secret disciples. They would, you know, because they didn't want to, the Jews would have kicked them out of the Sanhedrin if they
right.
would have known that they were, you know, secretly into Jesus and his miracles and so on. But it said that they brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 100 pounds.
Right.
And I think that's some of that stuff you were talking about earlier, the sugar.
Well, we would have gotten it. That's a completely different chemical makeup than what I was discussing, which was a treatment for the cloth by itself when it was being manufactured, not after Jesus had been laid in it. Now, let's talk about those spices for a second, because, you know, if you notice on the Shroud, there are no side images of the man's sides anywhere.
Okay.
And I believe, and this is just my own personal theory, that they may have taken jars or sacks of spices and placed them around the body with the intent of coming back to finish the preparation for burial that they were running out of time on because of the Sabbath. And when they laid the cloth over him, that would have then kept the sides from coming near enough to the cloth to be imaged. So that's one theory. Again, we can speculate on these things, but there are some things the Shroud can't tell us, and so we have to either interpolate.
Well, it helps to preserve the body because it was the manner of the Jews' way of burying with the spices, too.
Oh, absolutely.
As a form of preservation, but also, you know, in another chapter in that same book, it talks about when the first two disciples saw the grave that was open, and if you study that, you'll find a lot of information about your shroud, but it talks about the linen clothes that were lying there,
mm-hmm.
and then they said that there was a napkin that was about his head.
That's correct. That's a separate cloth.
Yeah.
It's kept in Oviedo, Spain. It's been there since the 6th century.
Gee, so they've got that, too.
It's called the Sudarium of Oviedo. It has blood stains and other fluid stains from the nose and mouth, but no image. It would have been removed from the body before they began to clean the body, but it would have been kept in the tomb, as it says in the Gospels, because remember, Jewish custom law is that any fluids or anything from the body have to be buried with the body so that when the Messiah comes and you're resurrected, you're intact. So all of these, even in modern-day Israel after a terror attack, they have righteous men going around picking up pieces of bodies and sopping up the blood and keeping it with the bodies so that it can all be buried together.
It would be interesting if we could match the blood from the shroud to this cloth.
Interestingly enough, George, some efforts have been made to do that. The problem with that is this. The only thing they could really do is a blood typing, and the frustrating part of that is old blood, the enzymes in blood that are responsible for the typing,
it
degrades.
Yeah.
And once they've degraded past a certain point, you'll always get a type AB. And that's what they found on the shroud, and that's what they found on the sedarium. But because all old blood types AB, it's not a valid comparison, unfortunately.
Next up, we go to Pasco, Washington, and it's Jeremy's turn. Hey, Jeremy, go ahead.
Hi, George. First-time caller. Hey, I was going to ask, he was talking about the side views. You can't see it, but he said that you can see the side wound on the shroud. I was wondering, it says in the scriptures that that water came out of the side wound.
That's correct.
Does it show any blood or anything else on as a stain?
The darkest blood stain on the shroud is from the spear or side wound. Now, when they say side, it was actually in the front of his body, not all the way off to the side of his body. What's most interesting, we haven't mentioned earlier, so you've brought up a very good question. Interestingly enough, surrounding the blood stains, just about all of them, but particularly the blood stain from the spear wound, is a serum stain that's only visible with UV fluorescence photography.
Wow.
And that's true of all the blood stains that have, you know, enough blood there for the serum to have separated. And Dr. Zugabe believes that the gush of water and blood or water and blood that came out of Jesus when they speared him was pleural fluid from his lungs and perhaps from his pericardial sac that was punctured by the spear. So we do have these serum stains that can only be seen with UV fluorescence photography. I defy some medieval forger to have thought of that in hopes that 700 or 800 years later somebody would find them. That's pretty ludicrous.
Exactly right. Hey, I had one more question about the first guy that took the pictures of the shroud, the photographer. Now, why did it turn out to be a negative?
The shroud is often referred to as maybe the first photograph. Well, it has one particular property very much like a photographic negative, and that is the lights and darks are reversed from what we're used to seeing. We're used to seeing a light highlight and a dark shadow. It's inverse on the shroud. Another thing that a forger would have had to have conceived of 500 years before the invention of photography. It's just not plausible. So what we have on the shroud, because the lights and darks are reversed, when you photograph it and you hold your negative up to a light, suddenly the lights and darks become more natural the way we're normally used to seeing people, you know, light highlights, dark shadows. And that's why the image of the shroud as it appears on a photographic negative, the dark background, lighter image of a man, that's the very famous, distinctive, and easily identifiable image of the shroud. So that is one of the – but sadly, that's about the only property of a photograph the shroud image has. Just about every other property is unlike any photograph I've ever seen, and I've seen quite a few in my 40-year career.
Let's grab one more call. Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, we go. Conway, it's your turn. You made it in.
Yeah, I did. Listen, guys, you're having a great program. I am not calling to affirm or deny the authenticity of the shroud having to do with Jesus. But I'm wondering if anyone has asked the question, because I've been told by a psychic in Spokane, as a matter of fact, mm-hmm. I've been told that according to her impressions, that the Jesus did not die on the cross at all. Rather, he was drugged. The family was wailing, going through the demonstrations of a grieved family. The soldiers were not physicians. It was late in the afternoon. They wanted to hit the bars and maybe the brothels, whatever. It was all quickly, the body was put into a tomb and later that night reopened and taken out, and they lived to be into his 70s and in Syria. and that he and his wife, Mary Magdalene, who was not a whore, by the way, they had four kids, and he died in his 70s, and so forth. Now, I'm not saying that I know that that's true.
Well,
I'm asking the question. Has anyone raised the question as to whether or not he actually died on the cross?
Yes,
okay,
absolutely.
And we've got a minute to go, so I'll let you answer it before we're done here, Brad.
Okay, ahead. I'll answer it as quickly as I can. What you're quoting is something called the swoon theory, that Jesus wasn't dead, that he was revived and spirited away. There's a tomb of Jesus in India where they believe he went and ultimately died, and somebody's buried in that tomb. I don't believe it was Jesus, but that's what some people believe. The swoon. So your psychic was really quoting a theory that's been around for a few hundred years, but the evidence on the shroud shows, and this is more confirmed by more than one forensic expert, the man is in rigor mortis. Only dead people go into rigor mortis. So the man on the shroud is dead. There's both post-mortem and some pre-mortem blood before his death, but mostly post-mortem blood. So it's highly unlikely that Jesus survived that cross. He probably died of several different types of shock. He had been given no water, anaphylactic shock, traumatic shock from the crucifixion. I don't think he survived it.
Thank you, Barry. Barry's book, Turin Shroud, there's a link of his website at coasttocoastam.com.